All right, well, let's start with a word of prayer and then get moving. Father God, we thank you and praise you for giving us your word, and we ask for your spirit of wisdom to help us to understand more about what your servants, what your apostles are trying to get forward, and help us to understand more about who you are in the process. Father, we thank you for all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen. Okay, we're going to be starting in Acts chapter 6 in verse 8, so we just kind of get a little context to where we're going here today. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did wonders and great miracles among the people. But some of those of the synagogue rose up, those called the Libertines, also some Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and some of those from Cilicia and Asia Minor, disputing with Stephen. And they had no strength to stand up against the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke. Then they induced men to be saying, "We have heard him speaking blasphemous words against Moses and God, and they have stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes." And coming on, they together seized him and led him up to the Sanhedrin. They stood him up, false witnesses, saying, "This man does not cease speaking blasphemous words against the holy place and the law. For we have heard him saying that this Jesus the Nazarene, which will destroy this place and will change the customs which Moses delivered to us." And looking intently at him, all those seated themselves in the Sanhedrin saw his face as if it were the face of an angel. And the high priest said, "Tell me, if then you thus hold these things." So that's the question we're going to be getting at today, is, number one, is Stephen speaking blasphemy? And are these things that are being held up against him really true? Now, when we see that what he was talking about here, if indeed they are true, it has some serious problems, because as we talked about the last time, if these charges are true, that would then disqualify Yeshua as being the Messiah, because that's not something that the prophet was going to do, come to speak something differently than what God has already said. So, as we were talking about before, we're going to take a look at this concept of blasphemy, because it's a very multidimensional look at what it means. You know, in Greek, primarily throughout the apostolic writings, we've got one word in Greek, it's blasphemia. That's it. But in the Tanakh, which is the Torah and the prophets and the writings, there are at least five Hebrew words that are used to display the shades of meaning that go into this. So what we're going to be looking at today are the shades of meaning with the question of, is Stephen speaking blasphemy? What is blasphemy? And why we should care about that? So, one of the first things we're going to be looking at is probably a word that you've seen before, but we're going to be looking at it in a slightly different context. And that is the verb barach. And barach. Now, anyone recognize that word? Anyone recognize it?
So what does it mean?
Well, you might have saying like, Baruch Ata Adonai. What does it mean in that context? Blessed are you. Blessed. Okay. Now, if any of you are interested in looking it up, it's in Strong's. If you use a lexicon with Strong's numbers, it's 1288. So if you have a lexicon that is tied to that one, it's kind of the real essential part of that is involving your knees. What you do with your knees, especially to someone in authority, mainly kneeling. So kind of has a sense of kneeling, which you might say, well, okay, barak. Okay, we understand it in blessing the Lord, but where on earth does this have any sort of sense that you're talking about blasphemy. Well, if you were to kind of look throughout the Tanakh, you see that barak, this verb here, is used 330 times throughout the Tanakh. However, in the sense of cursing, it's used 7 times. So we'll take a little bit closer look at this idea of cursing. Now, the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon kind of gives this idea to kind of get us going a little bit as to why this sense of blessing, how that could possibly fit with the idea of cursing. And we'll see that in some examples here. And the idea is that a blessing overdone so that it is a curse. That's kind of one idea of it. So the first step, the first place we'll take a look here is in 1 Kings 21. 1 Kings 21. So you'll probably recognize this one right off the bat. It's a passage that probably a lot of children heard in a sanitized context about King Ahab wanting to get into the wine business. And unfortunately, he didn't want to actually buy it. He wanted to acquire it through a hostile takeover. So the passage here that we got is, we'll see it in a couple of cases. Yes.
Actually, he did want to buy it. His wife was the one that decided to acquire it.
Yes. Isn't that convenient? Isn't that convenient? That's right.
The devil made her do it.
So in 1 Kings 21, so as we get going here, we'll see this guy, Naboth, or Naboth, or however you like to pronounce that one. Now, one of the interesting things we'll see here, if you skip down to verse 10, and if you recall in this story, since he wouldn't sell it, they did the hostile takeover. And the way they did the hostile takeover was to basically accuse him of blasphemy. So they'd knock him off. So down here, which is interesting because you'll notice a little bit of a similarity to the story of Stephen here before the Sanhedrin a little bit. Verse 10. So they set up these two men, sons of worthlessness, across from him, and they shall testify of him, saying, "You have cursed God and the king, and they shall bring him out and stone him." Okay, so this idea of cursing, that is where this idea of barak shows up as the idea of cursing. Now, the question here is that here we have an idea of blaming him for cursing God. Now keep that in mind about the idea of blasphemy and cursing God. You know, what are some ideas that we have on when you say cursing God? What do we think of? Swearing.
Taking his name in vain.
Taking his name in vain. We'll get to that one. Any other ideas about cursing God?
There are those that hate him because he did not come through for them, or because something happened in life that they thought he should have not done or done.
Okay, so basically blaming him for stuff in a way of cursing. All right. Let's go to a next passage here. It's another passage that we know quite well. It's in Job, the book of Job. So if you take a look at the book of Job, in the first chapter, we'll see one of these examples that we know quite well. You probably have heard this story about this back and forth between God and the accuser, the adversary, over Job and whether he was really righteous or not righteous. So as this back and forth goes between God and the adversary, look in verse 5 there.
What chapter?
Verse 1. First chapter. Verse 5. You know, and it happened when the days of feasting were gone, and gone around, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise up early in the morning and offer burnt sacrifices according to all their number. And Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." And this Job always did. So there you see someone that is, you know, talk about a father out there always interceding for his children there in the case that they might have cursed God in their hearts. You know, the idea that this is even more than they actually came out rightly and said that. He was, you know, pleading to God for mercy in the case that they might have cursed him in their hearts. Now, skip down to verse 11. And this is where after the accuser is making his case to God that basically, you know, he only likes you because you give him stuff. "But put out your hand now and touch against all that is his, and see if he will not then curse you to your face." So you're talking about a man we just saw that was interceding for his family in the case that perhaps his children may have inadvertently or through their thoughts or whatever wanted to go out and curse God. Now the adversary is saying, look, take away his stuff and he himself will curse you to his face. You know, in a more outright manner than just thinking about it. And then, of course, over in chapter 2 of this, we get around to where the accuser gets the green light to go and test Job. And you see down in, in verse 5, you get this, again, an appeal. "Put out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to his face." So after the cursing goes on, skip down to verse 11. Let's see. Yeah, verse 11? No, verse 9. That's right. It's 9 of chapter 2. "Yes, and his wife said to him, 'Are you holding still fast to your integrity? Curse God and die.'" So there you get kind of a sense as to this. You know, think of this in the idea of back to the original meaning of to kneel. To kneel as to show some sort of reverence too. And then kind of flipping it around to the opposite meaning of, you know, I guess in a not a sign of reverence and a sign of irreverence. So in a sense, when you think of kneeling as blessing the person who you're kneeling toward, you know, not kneeling in a context when you should kneel is a sense of giving a curse, which gives you kind of a sense as to we read later in the book of Esther and the book of Daniel, when Mordecai does not bow as Haman goes by, and when the three friends of Daniel do not bow to the image that was put up by Nebuchadnezzar, you get an idea of the opposite of blessing, the sense of cursing.
There's another way of looking at this thing. I'm bringing your point up on knees. And it's like says, and Job said, "It may be that their sons have said in sin and kneel their knee before God in their hearts." And they're not really blessing him. They're kind of phony. Kind of like a phony kneeling before God.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we'll get to another side of that one.
They're having this party here. His sons are having a party. He knows the party is not of God. And so he says he's going to sacrifice because they're, in a sense, doing it in the name of God, maybe, or something. And then they're kneeling before God, praising God, but really the party had nothing to do with God. You know what I'm saying? Kind of way of looking at this, and why he did that, because his sons were not doing what they should be doing in relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thinking. I'm thinking about it as going through all these things about kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
And to kneel before God and to curse God, well, kneel before him in a hypocritical sense or in a very negative way. Curse him by kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, take my life. And you're kneeling before him. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, so I can see how that works. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Daniel and his brethren didn't kneel out of... They could have knelt phonily too, but they didn't.
No, that was pretty outright.
Fake they were tying their shoes or something. But, they didn't do it either.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's a lot to the act too, I guess.
Yeah. Either overtly or not overtly. Well, another interesting place where this word here, Barak, is used is in Psalm 10. Now you turn over to Psalm 10. And in this case, we'll catch two words that are used throughout the Hebrew Scriptures for blasphemy. In Psalm 10, verse 3, "For the wicked boasts of his soul's desire and kneels to the covetous. He has despised Yahweh." So in that one, we see there that the first sense of this, the Barak, in there, with the idea of, with kneeling. Are there some other translations that you have that use something other than kneel?
Blesses.
Blesses.
Blesses the greedy and
renounces.
Yeah. So you got blesses, kneels to the covetous. And you get the other sense of the word in there. It's actually a different word in verse 3. It's one of the next ones that we'll actually look at, and that is na'atz. Na'atz. That is another term here, and that shows up in this verse right here. This version here says scorning the Lord. What does, or some other ways that you have it?
Mine says renounces.
Renounces, scorning, any other ways that that's rendered? Yeah?
Not other ways, but then what it would mean is yielding to the evil. Bowing your knee before the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Going along with the evil.
Subjugating yourself to it.
Subjugating yourself to the evil.
Yeah. And so you got kind of a dual sense in this regard, because you've got basically acquiescing, subjugating yourself to people who were acting in an evil manner, in the idea of covetousness. And then you have an active form of scorning the Lord.
Okay, in the Psalms it says, Lord, your enemies lie to you.
Hmm.
Which sounds funny, except in the commentaries it says, they lie to you saying, oh, we didn't know.
Hmm.
We didn't do it. Oh, we didn't mean to. Which, because they're afraid of him.
Hmm.
They lie to him because they're afraid of him.
Hmm. Well, that works really well, doesn't it? It worked for Ananias and Sapphira. It worked pretty well for them as well. So if any of you are curious about Na'atz, that is Strong's 5006. So if you're interested in looking up that at a point there. Now, one of the interesting things in here is this idea of abhorrent. Now, you have a King James Version, is that right?
Yeah.
How does the last part of that verse?
Right there.
Oh, okay. How does the last part of that
he
verse go?
He blesses the greedy and renounces, yeah. Verse 3.
Renounces.
Renounces.
Yeah. And,
same thing.
Really? Okay.
Despises.
So we get this idea of scorning, despising, you know, acquiescing. Is what you get the sense of kneeling going on with bless. So let's go on to...
You're in the act of doing this, you're doing that. That's what it boils down to.
Basically.
That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, because you get that kind of a parallel idea in one word explaining the other word.
That's correct.
Yeah. So... And that indeed is actually kind of a helpful thing when you're going through like Proverbs and Psalms, particularly, and also some of the other prophetic writings that do that kind of a parallel structure, in that, you know, if one part of a verse or a section is a little bit confusing, they often say the same thing or the opposite thing a different way in the next line down. So sometimes if you're having trouble understanding it in one verse or one line, you can oftentimes look at the last or the next line down and get an explanation of it. So a little bit more on na'atz, the word there. Various ways that it's translated are spurn, to form contempt, or to contemn, which is a very old verb for that. A despise, to abhor. One of the places where this shows up a lot is in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel in chapter 10. So in 2 Samuel... Yes, yeah. 2 Samuel, looking at, I'm sorry, chapter, yeah, I'm excited here, it's chapter 12, not chapter 10. This is following, the context of this is following the incident with Bathsheba, and this is where Samuel is coming to deliver the bad news to David in this regard.
Is that with Samuel or Nathan?
Sorry, Nathan. Yes, thank you. I got the prophets all goobered up there. And with this idea in verse 14 of 2 Samuel, you get two senses of this, which are actually quite helpful in understanding, you know, the concept of na'atz, is that in verse 14, you've got this, you know, you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. You have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. Now, in that sense, you've got the passive form of this, which means that you're kind of, or I should say the causative form of that, meaning that you're causing something to happen, and also the active form of that. So causing someone to abhor, despise the Lord, and also with the actual despising on that. Now, how was it that David caused the nations to despise, abhor the Lord, you know, spurn, bring contempt upon the Lord by what he did with Bathsheba? How did he do that?
Because he was the king, he had a copy of the Torah, that supposedly written. And he was at the head of the nation, leading the nation, and he was trying to make something look good that was really sin by all of his fandangling of having Bathsheba's husband murdered in a very surreptitious way, dishonest way, and then marrying her. He was trying to make good look good as sin and hide it.
Any other ideas?
He also wasn't out leading his men, which he would never have gotten into trouble if he'd been where he was supposed to begin with.
Exactly. Where the guy he whacked was out there with the men instead of him.
What?
Lost his heart for battle. His heart was going in a different direction. But what do we know from history about the way that the royal families of the other nations around Israel at this time period, and even continued long after that, what do we know about their behavior? Pretty much the same thing of what David was doing. You know, whacking each other, you know, jumping into bed with each other. It was exactly the same kind of thing. So here you go. You have the king of Israel, supposed to be the nation started by God, led by God, this and that and the other. You know, the king, supposed to be the leader. He's acting no different than any of the nations around him. In fact, the guy he whacked was a foreigner, you know, who was more had more loyalty to God in that regard and the armies of Israel than David did. So what does that kind of tell you about this idea of bringing contempt upon the Lord? This kind of a shade of meaning of blasphemy.
It's a hypocritical. It's hypocritical.
In other words, you perceive one thing, but you look as if you're one thing, but really it's another.
Mm.
Like the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
You hypocrites. You tithe mint and dill and cumin, but you neglect the weighty issues of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what's more, what makes them such a blasphemous thing is, you know, anybody can be a hypocrite, and oftentimes we are without realizing it. But as you point out, he was the king. He mm-hmm. was leading the nation. So, therefore, he's explicitly, he has the role of being the representation of God's kingdom to the world. So his action was especially blasphemous, given his role.
Hmm.
Just high visibility.
Well, yeah, not only that, is that if you are the leader, in a sense, by your actions, you're somewhat being a leading people on the behavior that God finds acceptable, which is why...
happens all the time.
Of course it does.
I mean, the way a president acts,
yes.
The whole nation says, oh, okay.
Even the way the kings acted in the yeah. Book of Kings is how the people
are. Yep, exactly right.
That's what you do.
Exactly, which is always why I like the defense. Well, I was just doing what the people wanted. Yeah, that works really well. Yeah, it sure does. Let's see here. One of the places that we catch another shade of meaning of the idea of blasphemy is in Psalm 74. Psalm 74, we catch a new word that's used to talk about blasphemy throughout the Bible. And Psalm 74... down in verse 10. Yeah. O God, how long shall the enemy defame you? Shall the enemy scorn your name forever? Okay. So we have scorn, defame and scorn. And there. The first word, defame. Does anyone have a kind of a different way that that's translated? It's Psalm 74, verse 10. Psalm 74, verse 10.
Blasphemy.
It says, talks about blasphemy.
Mine has, will the foe jeer at us?
Jeer, okay, that's interesting. Mock?
Mock.
All right. Now, how's the last one? You know, shall the enemy scorn your name forever? Any other renderings for that? What?
Insult your name forever.
Insult. Okay. And we were talking about that one. We're going to get down to the next one. Is Hara. That's going to be the next word we get to. So this is the third one we've gotten to so far is Charaf. That's the word that is translated as scorn and such like that. So in this sense, what kind of shades of meaning do we get in this verse here? In this Psalm 74:10. What shades of meaning do we get for what it means to blaspheme? Now, first off, what is defamation? It says about defaming the Lord. What does defamation mean?
Speak bad about.
Speak bad about, yeah. So if you get sued for defamation, someone is accusing you of saying bad stuff or injury and slander. That's the another way to put that.
Which isn't true.
Yeah.
Saying something bad about you that isn't true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, the funny thing is that this is an interesting concept to think about. But sometimes you can defame somebody by speaking the truth. You can defame somebody by speaking the truth.
Yeah. It's basically because D, that prefix, is basically meaning undoing something.
Ah.
You are undoing someone's reputation. You're stealing from them, actually, in essence, because no longer in front of people are they the person that they once were.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how you get those little shades of meaning between famous and infamous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to be famous, but you don't want to be infamous. No, certainly not.
In this day and age, some people don't know the difference and they don't care.
Yeah, sometimes people strive for...
They'd rather have infamy than have no fame at all.
Yeah, your 15 minutes of infamy, yes. I don't think I would strive for that. But we get this idea of, in this next word in there, of reproach, taunting, defying, jeopardizing, railing against, upbraiding, are some ways that this is translated. This next word that we have here, charaf, which, if you're interested, is Strong's number 2778. So if you're thinking of going back and looking up the shades of meaning on this, and which I encourage, if you happen to have a lexicon that will go through and list the various times in the Bible where the same word is used. This is very, very helpful. Often if you have a Strong's Concordance, it goes one direction. It'll show you the various words that are used, like, you know, an exhaustive Strong's Concordance will on one side have a column that will show you these numbers right here, these Strong's numbers, to tell you that if one word is being used versus another word. So it's always kind of a good idea.
Helps keep you out of trouble.
Helps keep you out of trouble. We don't like to be in trouble. Yes. But some places that where we have kind of an interesting meaning of the idea of bringing reproach upon. Just mention this briefly. This is in Leviticus 19:20. This is just talking about when you have a slave woman and pledged for someone. Now, that the word that is often translated, they might say, you know, betrothed to or married to or committed to or something like that. That's the same word here, this charaf idea of bringing some sort of reproach. But one of the things that we're going to take a look at for this word charaf is another famous account that we have of David and Goliath. This word charaf shows up a lot in that passage right there. So in that passage where we have in 1 Samuel 17, which Daniel will be getting to here, and Very breakneck speed, yes. Yes. He'll be in chapter 17 very quickly. But to give you kind of a preview of coming attractions, this passage here of David and Goliath shows up in here in the challenge that both Goliath offers to the people of Israel, the army of Israel that's gathered there, and also about what David says to the army. Now, what is it that you see there, like in verse 10 with Goliath's taunt? And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me this man and we will fight together," calling for a champion of Israel to come out and fight him. So any other variations on defy in the translation you have? Everybody have defy? It's verse 10 in 1 Samuel 17. Anybody have any other variations? Everybody says defy? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what does it mean that he was calling to defy here? I defy the ranks of Israel this day. What is he in effect saying?
Defying God.
But what does that mean? He's standing there. You know, remember, this is where, one army's on one hill, one army's in the other hill. He's down there in the valley saying, come down. Okay, send a champion down to challenge me. He is standing there. Okay, he's defying the army. Now, you might remember, how long was he down there?
40 days.
Yeah, he was out there, went out there for 40 days.
Waiting for a champion.
I mean, can you imagine that? 40 different days. He was marching out there. They went through the same charade. They would, one army would go out to one hill. One army would go out to the other hill. He would go down in the valley and say, come on out. Now, he was standing there in the valley in defiance. Now, what was he saying to Israel by his presence there, and what was Israel saying to him?
Your God isn't 10 feet.
You're tall. We're not so tall, so we're not going down there. That's what Israel, in effect, was saying. He's too big. Every time he would come close, they would scatter back. Yeah.
Yeah, Clark, when he goes over this text, Adam Clark, when he goes over this text, he translates it to analyze it. He translates it as, "I strip and make bare the armies of Israel." So basically, in that sense of it, is Goliath is basically saying, "Your army isn't worth anything if you can't even bring me one man to fight against me. I don't care how many people you have out there. If you can't bring one man to fight against me, your army's worth nothing."
Yeah. So we get that sense there, and down a little bit further, in like in verse 26, you get David now talking to the army of Israel. And verse 26, "And David said to the men who were standing with him, 'What shall be done to the man who strikes this Philistine and turns aside disgrace from Israel? And who is the uncircumcised Philistine that he should disgrace the armies of the living God?'" So here we got this Charaf show up again. Now, what is David saying in here?
Who does he think he is?
Yeah, who does he think he is?
Besides, after 40, 40 is a time of trial.
Mm-hmm.
God delivers after 40.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in the sense of this, what was Israel telling Goliath during those 40 days?
You're afraid of him.
We don't know what to do.
God is dead. There is no God. God is dead. Our God is dead. Our God will not go down in the valley with us. So that is, in a sense, what the army of Israel was telling, which is why David was back to him saying, look, we have the living God here. It's going to go down with us into the valley. One of the other accounts, this is probably where a lot of you kind of know this idea of blasphemy from, and that is in 2 Kings 18 and 19 regarding the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem under King Hezekiah. Yeah.
They may have been praying during those 40 days. They may not have figured, he may have figured their God was dead, but Israel may have been saying, oh my goodness, God help us, God help us, God help us. They
yeah.
were not convinced he was dead.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah? Now, in 2 Kings here, with this siege of Jerusalem, this is probably one of those times where you get a real, get a pretty vivid sense of the idea of blasphemy. Now, the Assyrian king sends out this guy, this general, Rabshakeh. And you see, like in chapter 19, in verses 4 and 16, especially right in the beginning, you know, there's this sense of Hezekiah being dismayed by what this guy is saying, what Rabshakeh is saying, and what he's levying against Israel in this regard. And you get this sense also. And look at chapter 19 in verse 22. Chapter 19 and verse 22. Whom have you reproached and reviled? Against whom have you lifted up a voice? Yea, you have lifted up your eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel. So here you have a sense of King Hezekiah's retort back to Rabshakeh on this. And here we get another of, this is be word number 4 in our look at these various words that are used. We get the first one there that we've been talking about, the cheref. And then you've got the other word in there is Gaddaf. Not Gaddafi, Gaddaf. Yes. And Gaddaf, if you folks are interested in here, it's in Strong's, let's see here. Gaddaf.
You know, add one dot and you've got the.
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which.
It's
food for thought. Huh? Seeing how closely Arabic and Hebrew are related, sometimes you have to wonder.
Yeah.
Especially when you see what Gaddaf means. 1442. Not a year I remember well, fortunately. 1442, Strong's number for Gaddaf there. And various ways that that is translated, it's often translated as reviling. And we'll see it also connected with another sense of it. But here in this retort against Rabshakeh, we see it used here in these two cases of reviling. Now, how was it that Rabshakeh, if you remember from chapter 18 of this passage, how was Rabshakeh reviling, bringing reproach, bringing, you know, despisement upon the Lord? Let's take a look at a couple of these passages here that kind of give us a sense on it. For example, look in chapter 18 in, you know, it's in the middle of his long rant there, in verse 25. Oh, we're still in 2 Kings. Still in 2 Kings, chapter 18, in verse 25. This is the midst of where he's basically, you know, calling out to these representatives that have come outside the wall, but definitely loud enough so everybody could hear him. It was on the wall. And he starts out with this thing in verse 22, talking about that they put their trust in Yahweh and such. And down in 25, he says, "Now have I come up against this place to destroy it without Yahweh? Yahweh said to me, 'Go up against this land and you shall destroy it.'" So, when you say about the ways of bringing contempt and reviling against the Lord, what is it that Reb Shekha is saying to those people there in Jerusalem? Because remember, this is after he plowed right through Samaria. You know, he came in and wiped out Samaria, hauled off the kingdom of Israel. So now he's down there knocking on the doors of Jerusalem. And he's saying, look, I already took over Samaria. I already wiped out all your northern cousins up there. Now I'm here. And he's saying, oh, the Lord told me to come down here and do this. So here you have this challenge. And it goes on later in this chapter to say, look, don't listen to King Hezekiah. He's telling you, oh, the Lord is going to protect you. The Lord is going to save you. Don't listen to him. Now, obviously, the Lord is with me because I've plowed through Samaria already. And here I am showing up on your doorstep. So you get a little bit of a sense also in this blasphemy. So when you think of this in the context, what then is another shade of blasphemy in the context of what Reb Shekha is saying to the defenders of Jerusalem here?
Lying about what God says.
Yeah, lying about what God says. That's another shade that you get of blasphemy, is that you are representing as saying something that the Lord did not say. So that kind of gives you another meaning when you think of Stephen there before the Sanhedrin and this leveling, this charge, especially that he was blaspheming the Lord and Moses and going out to change the customs of Moses on this, that you get this sense of these shades of meaning there. Not only bringing outright reviling, but also the idea of trying to go out and change what it was that was originally said, saying that he was speaking for God, and that Yeshua was God's anointed. And I guess the claim was that he was not. Finishing off with this word of Harath here is a passage from Isaiah 65. Now, if you remember Isaiah and how Isaiah kind of rolls along, these passages, these last few chapters of Isaiah are, you know, talking about, you know, the context of it here. It gets towards that moment of the day of the Lord and afterward. So here in Isaiah 65, as you start out, you get this this sense of looking forward on this. And it gets into some of the prophecies that you see also in Ezekiel and Jeremiah as well on some of the things that will come toward the day of the Lord. And you get this sense like there in verse 1 that I have sought. I have been sought not by those who asked. I have been found not by those who sought me, to a nation not calling on my name. And if you skip down to verse 6, he says, "Behold, it is written before me, I will not be silent except I repay. Yea, I will repay to their bosom your iniquities and the iniquities of your fathers together, says the Lord. They that burned incense on the mountains and have blasphemed me on the hills, and I will measure their former work on their bosom." So you get this word there shows up again in this passage. Now, how was Israel, as you see here, or these people, how were they bringing some sort of despisement upon the Lord? By what they were doing. What were they doing?
The Israelites?
Yeah, the people who are described here in this prophecy.
They were eating unclean food.
Yeah, they were just kind of...
incense to other gods.
Kind of just hitting, going down the checklist of all the things that poke God in the eye. Kind of hitting all the major buttons there. Now, yeah.
It's hitting on the kind of sins, because there are all sorts of sins that God mentions in the Bible, and he kind of uses all sorts of different terms for different classifications of sins. These kind of sins are, for the most part, ones that he classifies as abominations. You got eating pork or eating unclean food is an abomination. The burning incense of idols is abomination. So these are the most obvious jabbing in the eye kind of sins.
Yeah. And we'll get to, yes.
This is also, he's talking about the people he has called. He's mm-hmm. talking about either Judah or Israel or the combination of them both.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is sought by them for people, my translation is a little bit different, but it says, I was sought by those who didn't ask for me. We're not talking about Israel, my people, or Judah, my people. He's saying somebody else wants me. I was found by those who didn't even seek me. I said, here I am, to a nation that wasn't even called by my name. I've stretched out my hands all day long to a rebellious people who walk in a way that isn't good according to their own thoughts, a people who provoke me to anger continually to my face, who sacrifice in gardens, who burn incense on altars of bricks, who sit among the graves and spend the night in the tombs, who eat pigs and the broth of all kinds of garbage, who say, keep to yourself, don't come near me, for I'm holier than you. These are smoke in my nostrils, a fire that burns all the day. These are people who know, but don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Not a people who said, I'm in such trouble. Hi, God, will you save me?
Yeah.
A different people.
And you're getting at a little bit of this meaning. Because this shows up, this Gaddaf word shows up in a different sense. And... it's not what you would call a good sense, because in Numbers 15:30, we've gone through it in our Torah studies before, but it gives you this idea, as the New American Standard puts it, as defiantly, King James puts it, presumptuously. But this is not just doing, you know, the King James says doing ought or doing evil, doing stuff. It is doing it defiantly. It's doing it, you know, as the RSV puts it, the Revised Standard, you know, with a high hand. This is not just your regular stuff. It is whatever, pushing God's buttons, not just because you don't know any better, not because you slipped up or, as you say, you were deceived, tricked into doing it or... you know, enticed into it or something like this. This is purposefully going ahead and doing this.
Yes, and you don't
purposefully. Like, yeah, exactly. Sticking it right in God's eye. That's pretty much where this is going with this word here. And one of the things that you also see with this, kind of in connection of this passage here in Isaiah 65, and Peter also gets to it in the first of his letters in chapter 2. He lists this prophecy about to people who, you know, were not called by me or this or that or the other, to people who were not a people I called my people. So he's wrapping up a lot of these ideas that, you know, God had basically dispelling this idea that God had cast off his people. But he's saying, no, he brought them back. But he brought them back for a purpose. And Peter goes on to say that, you know, your conduct, you know, he says, keep your behavior excellent among the nations. That's basically what he says. He's calling them back, but for a purpose, because your behavior is supposed to be above reproach, not, you know, pushing God's buttons. That's not the behavior that God is calling for. And just lastly here, because we got to close up, the last word that we get at is Nakav.
Nakav. There we go.
Hello. And that is Strong's 5344. If you want to take a look at it, 5344. Or depending on how you want to pronounce the last one, either Nakav or Nakav. This sense is where you'll see it, the various shades of meaning used as to pierce, to perforate, to bore, to appoint, to designate, and to curse. And we'll just leave lastly with this idea, and this is a passage that's found in Leviticus 24. And you get a really interesting sense of the idea of blasphemy from this one. And you get also a little sense of where these acute accusations against Stephen were going in this. In Leviticus 24, you get this man who was brought in, and in verse 11, it says that this man blasphemed the name and cursed. Blasphemed the name and cursed. So this brings up the Nakav, the there of blaspheming, is how the New American Standard puts it, and using cursed with the word going along with it of Leviticus 24. Leviticus 24 and in verse 11. And it kind of continues on with it in verse 16. But you get also on this is the word that goes along with it of kalal. And kalal is a very important idea in this because it gives the idea of to be slight, to be light, trifling, to make of little account. So when you read this together with this charge that's made against this man here in Leviticus 24, that he blasphemed the name and made it of little account, or made it trifling. So you get this, what does that sound like? Think of third commandment, you know. Many people say, you know, do not take the Lord, the name of the Lord, your God, in vain. Well, literally it means to make it of no account, to make it worthless, to make it of really no meaning. And one of the other things that you can say with this Nakav word here is that it is used in the, you know, that transaction between Jacob and Laban. And they're talking about, he's saying, okay, designate for yourself. It's translated there, designate. So this thing of there is basically pointing to something, to single it out. So in a sense, with this thing in Leviticus 24, you're like saying that this guy was designating, singling out, pointing to something specific, and making it of little account. That is why he got such an incredibly harsh sentence upon him. It kind of gets to this idea of blasphemy and being, when it says cut off from the people, they were cut off with rocks. Yeah, not a pleasant sort of thing there. So, leaving with the question before we pick it up with chapter 7 next time is, how was Stephen, as we've been seeing with all these five words here, how is he cursing, reviling, reproaching, taunting, defying, spurning, bringing contempt upon, despising, abhorring, or I guess you could say bringing contempt or all these things upon God or upon Moses, and in the bigger sense, Moses in that time frame also kind of meant the traditions that went along with it and the interpretations throughout the sages throughout time was kind of wrapped up into that idea of when they would mention Moses in there. So not just Torah, but also interpretation on Torah as, yeah. So that's the question we'll take a look at, because a lot of enemies of God have, you know, made it quite the shooting gallery in Acts chapter 7 to poke holes in the apostles, because they were a lot of ignorant folk who obviously had never read the Tanakh ever before. That's a lot of charges that come out of Acts chapter 7. So as we go through Stephen's defense, there's a lot of things that come out of there. And remember that a lot of what Stephen is quoting from is Septuagint, as we'll look in that. And that differs from what you'll see in the Masoretic, which is what most English translations of the Hebrew Scriptures are representing. So that is the end of that. Let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us your word and for explaining so many different ways who you are and what you mean. Father, help us to have a heart that's molded by you, a heart that's changed by you, so that we will never be in defiance or cause other people to defy you or scorn you or ridicule you by what we do. Father, we thank you for all these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.